Hi, I'm Tom Scott. Joined as always, RP Eddie. RP, good to see you. 2 days in a row, we've had Neil Phillips. 2 days ago, you and I spoke to Neil. Yesterday, we showed a flashback conversation that Neil had with Norman Lear at the Nantucket Project a couple of years ago, which was a beautiful conversation. You think about this show, and if you haven't seen the 5 minute film that sort of introduces why I would have called RP in the onslaught of COVID back when, it tells a nice story. Like, oh, it makes a lot of sense. You'd want to talk to this guy on this day. And then, you know, one of the things we discovered in the world of COVID that, among other things, it was very confusing. So information was very helpful, and somebody with the breadth to understand it, but then also to package it and also to think about it, hopefully with the ethos of what TNP brings, which is sort of this idea of like, let's not create clickbait as much as possible. Let's stay away from a lot of the politics and let's focus on humanity in the midst of all the solid information. Like, that's kind of the show that we unknowingly built, by the way, because we didn't know what would happen the next day. And so here it is a few months later. And it seemed like the moment we went back outside, you know, the country went into this entirely new place. I do want to add that when I think about my life, and only because I know mine, right? It's the list, and I know this is true in other people's lives. The first thing I'll say is that I don't sleep the way I used to sleep. I go to bed later and I wake up later. I don't sleep as much. And I think it relates to the fact that there's fear, there's health fears. There's, you know, I have the concerns for my children. There's 25% unemployment. There are business challenges that are, you know, unprecedented. And then as some of that tension grows, we come into this difficult historic moment, the Floyd incident, and then the aftermath. And here we are today. And it's a lot. Like, that's a lot. That's a lot to take in. So, you know, the question is, what does this Tom and RP thing have to do with what's going on now? And it's a good question, you know, and that's part of the reason that we brought Neil on is, you know, Neil's a trusted guy who I think believes in our ethos, and he's a brilliant thinker. And there's a lot we could have learned from Neil. And I thought we did learn so much from Neil in this process. And so what does that say for today? What is this show today? And, you know, I feel like for me, you know, the markers of this day for me are largely derived from a talk that Barack Obama gave, a letter that George Bush wrote, and a letter that James Mattis wrote. Now, there's a lot of other stuff. Richmond is going to take down the Robert E. Lee statue based in Richmond, I think on orders from the governor. You know, Stephen King voted out, you know, or loses. There are other things. There's a lot going on. You know, there's a lot going on. And obviously demonstrations, et cetera. But I, you know, as I read those letters and I listened to Barack Obama speak, I thought, and I was saying this to James earlier on our team, who's a younger guy, I said, you know, I've seen the bad incidents, you know, and I said Rodney King in particular was a really difficult moment. There are plenty of others. But this is the first time I've seen anything like this. The reaction for me in my life is new. For me. And I think, by the way, I think anyone who's around my age, let's say since the 60s, the reaction seems to be one of a kind. Anyway, I did want to sort of set up, like, this was a show that was born in COVID. This is a show that we don't know where it may go, right? But today, that's the best way I can sort of describe what brought us here. You and I are, you know, two guys who, you know, we are white males who our own life experiences are what they are. And so we come today in this conversation from that place as best we can.
Fair. Hear, hear. And I say thank you a lot, but I hope I don't ever stop. Like, this has been such a privilege for me. You know, to me, it's, I get to spend time with you, a very bright person who has a whole emotional heart aspect that I don't have as much of. So I get to learn from you, not only what your background is, who you are, but I think that there's a complementary intelligence to the way I think that I really enjoy. I get to set my day up talking to brilliant people, including you and others, about what's going on in the world. And I hope that others feel the same way when they get to listen to this. I get to be part of the conversations we're having with people on social media and friends that call me up and email me and text me about the conversations that we're having on this show. And, you know, that's unbelievably positive. So thank you. And yeah, I guess we started talking about Corona, but Corona is fascinating in that it has scientific aspects, economic aspects, sociological aspects, government aspects, and so does where we find ourselves now. And these protests, I'm pretty sure, wouldn't be as broad or deep if it weren't for the fact we had been under lockdown for 3 months, or however you do your math, and wouldn't be as broad and deep if we hadn't had maybe so much time as a nation to contemplate where we are. You know, there was, for some people, those who didn't have to go to work, and that's not everybody, there was a bit of a slowdown in life, and maybe in the slowdown in life, we got to look at things a little more closely, a little more longly. And it could be just looking at your family and your kids, which I've really been pleased I've gotten to do and build those connections, or it could be looking at the world around you. And I think Obama used the expression, it brings everything into a sharp relief, right? That's what's happening right now. So that's what happened in the warm-up, you know, That's what happened during our lockdown. And that's what's happening right now as things are becoming much more focused on a lot of the challenges the station has. And yeah, there's been a ton of news that's happened in the last few days. You know, it's funny, Corona is no longer on the headlines, the protests are. And a lot of the things you mentioned are extremely newsworthy, right? So we have the letter from, and of those letters, right, of the things that have happened. So Steve King gets voted out in a primary. Good riddance, racist, that's awesome, right? So that shows that, you know, maybe that shows that some aspects of the far right or the further right are losing power. I mean, that's what you'd want to believe when you see that. Richmond taking down the statue of a treasonous war leader. Awesome, right? And there's all these fascinating conversations about what the Confederacy flag, the flag of the Confederacy means. And I will say, just as a footnote, not that we're having that big conversation, I think a lot of people historically who have had that flag, you know, on their, in their house, in their car or whatever, weren't doing it out of overt racism, but were doing it out of a sense of, you know, sort of regional pride. But regardless, whatever they were doing, it's unacceptable and it's treasonous. And so I'm so glad America's coming around to that. And then most news, and then Obama's talk, I thought was great. And I thought his restraint was sort of the, what was newsworthy, right? He didn't talk about, if you watched it, and I didn't see the end of the panel, but the little talk he gave, he didn't mention the president. He didn't mention politics. He just talked about the moment, put it in context. And I think if you had the same speech from, you know, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, if he happened to be African-American, you'd find the same thing. It was totally nonpartisan. And so I'd say restraint was the key word from that. And then you have the letter from Donald Trump's selected Secretary of Defense, a person he politically appointed to be his Secretary of Defense, General Mattis. And that's super newsworthy as well. So a lot's happened in the last few days. And that's beyond the protests and the disease.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things, I call the guy who studied this, Simon Greer, for 30 years. And let's call this some part the civil rights movement, broadly speaking. When I say broadly speaking, what I'm trying to say is he's done a lot of work around the Holocaust. He's done a lot of work around Israel. He's done a lot of work around the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King, et cetera, in the United States. He's broadly, this is his world. And, you know, he talks about the cycle when these things happen and how they come and go. And he's probably someone we should speak to. And he sort of, you know, one of the things that stays with me is he said, you're going to feel afraid because you're going to feel like you have to say the right thing and do the right thing. And you're not going to know what that is. And he said, but try not to be so afraid. and try to have really productive conversations with people of any kind. You know, what are the things that you could do within your family, within your friend set, one race, two race, multi-race, and just try to do it with a certain level of courage and then humility, right? The humility side of it, I think, is so critical because there's only so much we know. If we knew so much, if we were so bright, well, that whatever that idea is would have already been enacted. We wouldn't be having this whole thing if it was so easy, you know? And because it's hard, it means a lot of us have to work hard. And if you're not working hard right now, maybe you're not working enough, you know, or maybe you're not working at all. And when I say work, I mean, what is a courageous conversation? Well, it's probably going to be a little bit difficult. If it's going smoothly, maybe you're not doing the right thing at that time. I don't know. I'm speculating to a certain extent, but I found that very, very helpful. You know, the thing about Obama, I say this a lot because people are suspicious of this, that, or the other thing, whatever it is, NSA. And I say to a lot of people, I say, what do you think of Barack Obama? Do you think he's a trustworthy guy? And that universally, I mean, there are exceptions, of course, but people say, yeah, I think he's a really trustworthy guy. And I said, well, you know, he was in charge of the NSA at one time and the CIA. And there's certain things that even good people, right? So I use him as an example of sort of a beacon of someone who seems like, I mean, that whole no drama Obama thing, I give the guy a ton of credit. Like there's something about him as a person that I think is pretty unique in modern times. And, you know, to run for president requires a certain level of ego. Okay, I get that. But on the other hand, I feel like the trust I feel that I have, I'm speaking for myself, is pretty profound. And so when I was watching him speak, it made me feel really good. And I just want to add, you know, he talked about practices and policies, which is great. I'm a little less interested in that. I'm all for it, you know, longer term. Shorter term, I want to like feel the man, feel the time. And he did that too, by the way. But part of what he said was sort of in that vein. But then he started talking about using this moment. And, you know, it's kind of like when Stacey said, put people first. And I paused and said, come on, people, listen to what she just said and be literal in what she's saying, not, oh, isn't that nice? And the way that Obama said it, I felt like, okay, I'll listen to you. By the way, he's not the first, but actually think about what this moment is and use this moment. Now, part of that, okay, so why am I saying this? I'm saying this because we've spoken a lot about leadership. In that moment, he's leading me. In that moment, I feel a certain something where I think, oh, wow, I haven't felt that in a little bit, right? Which is to say, I'm going to sit and be led, and to his demeanor and the words he said really made me feel that way and made me feel all of a sudden somewhat useful. And here's what I'm countering against, okay? I'm just going to be clear. I don't want to do what the internet says. The internet says, this is big, react to it. Now do that, react to it. Now do this, react to it. That's why it goes away in 5 days. You heard Neil say it, like 5 days from now, something else. And I have this very strong sense of like, I'm 54 years old. I'm not going to do what the internet says today because I don't think that works very well. And what Obama said was use this moment. And I don't know what that answer is. I don't know exactly what it is. I think we can play our own role. But I think we need to think about that. Don't let the internet tell us what to do tomorrow. I'm speaking broadly, but go ahead.
I think in our conversation with Neil, there was, which by the way, was fascinating. And I'm reflecting on it all day, and a lot of people who watched the video, I mean, that was amazing. And I think I learned so much from that in an area that's very new to me. I mean, this is not an area where I have expertise, right? So back to your initial comments, it's an area where I can feel uncomfortable. It's an area where I'm really, really nervous that I'm going to hurt or offend somebody who has every right to be extraordinarily sensitive at these times in general, you know? And even that comment, like, am I allowed to say that? Sensitive at these times. You mean, what do you mean? We're sensitive all the time. Ah, sensitive. You know what? Geez, what's the right word? Is it inclusive? Is it, you know, I don't know. It's a very hard area. And I'm highly drawn to the idea, just going, this will make sense in a second, highly drawn to the idea of not trying to offend or hurt anybody right now. And I want to be extremely careful with what I'm saying. At the same time, there's so much to learn and to say, and that's a messy process. So that's part one. Part two, in the conversation with Neil, partly because this the contours of conversations around race and the contours about the experience that African-Americans have had versus my experience and my inability to understand it from their point of view and vice versa, et cetera, et cetera. It's so messy that I think I instinctively went to in that conversation, like, what do we do about it? And I said, what is the concrete change that we make? And Neil, thank God, you know, was interested in that aspect too. And I guess I say thank God because it's a comfortable place for me to be, right? I can be comfortable making plans and strategies and how does government change and how do you move org charts and, you know, and then you brought the conversation back to love and heart. And I've been reflecting on that a lot. And I think because when you get back into the love and heart area, again, it becomes a murky area that I'm not expert in. I bounce back to a concrete fix. When Obama says use this moment, and you talk about how you reflected on Obama's initial conversation being about policy, he talked about the Our Brothers Keeper initiative, talked about commissions and task forces and numbers and things that were like, you know, concrete policy frameworks. And then he did get back around to shared experience. I'm intrigued by that too, because like it's sort of the Mars Venus thing. Like, you know, I want to solve, I want to fix, and how do we use this moment? And I also know from historical precedent, and I think we discussed this before, there was an attempt to kill Martin Luther King before they were eventually successful, that led to by a bombing that led to a series of riots in the South, protests and riots in the South, and JFK was urged to get engaged with this the beginning of his presidency. And initially he gave a very short statement and then it wasn't enough. And then he had to push for legislative change. Now there was an aspect of legislation that was going on at the time that led to some of the protests, but he had to go to a concrete change. And we talked a little bit with Neil and President Obama mentioned a couple of things that are concrete changes, but I'm really excited to see what they are. And they're not going to be things the internet tells you to do. It's not going to be putting a black screen on your Facebook page. Concrete changes. So they're taking down the statue of Robert E. Lee in Richmond. That's concrete. Steve King gets voted out of the primary. Awesome.
It's big.
These streets are full of...
Those are big deals. Those are big deals.
They're super big. And then these protests, right? And Obama, we discussed a little bit, and Obama made the point. It's a multiracial, multigenerational group of people that are getting out there. And a lot of the folks are doing it believing they're putting themselves at double risk. One, risk of police violence, and the other, risk of disease. Like, that's a beautiful thing. And I have a lot of friends who are very socially active of different races who want to protest, but they're like, I'm worried about the disease. So there will be even more people out there. And that's a concrete change too. So what do we do with this? And then you have Mattis come out and say, well, I'll tell you what you don't do about it, right?
So let's go to Bush, okay? I want to say one thing about Bush that is critical here as a matter of background. I'll never do it justice, and if you want to take a crack at it, RP, feel free. I listened to George Bush explain why he does not believe that former presidents should weigh in.
Yeah.
And for whatever you might think of the man, his philosophy was so powerful when he laid it out. And it had to do with a respect for the office. And it had to do, I would say, first and foremost, with a kind of humility. Like, I think he actually has a pretty intense level of humility. And I don't think it's surprising that the Obamas and the Bushes, the George W. Bushes, are so close, because I think they share that. And there's a passion in it. It's not just like a philosophy. He's like passionate about the philosophy. Okay, so first of all, he wrote a letter. He's been drawn to a point. This isn't like, oh, it's time for me to do my letter. This is an emergency of sorts. This is an extraordinary moment. And therefore, I'm going to write a letter. And I don't mean an extraordinary moment. I'll go one degree further. An extraordinary indication of not only a lack of leadership, but maybe more poisonous leadership. Now, I'm speculating on that last part, but I think I'm right. That this is something that in under normal circumstances he would not do, and he wouldn't do it in this specific way. Because this is pretty specific. He does say things that are specifically reactive to certain things that have happened. I want to stop there for now. And just like, how do you feel about what I just said?
So it's fascinating. You know, in the beginning of the Trump presidency, there were a bunch of like little memes. There were jokes, obviously, of George Bush being like, "I don't look so bad now," right?
Right.
And he was an extremely polarizing president while he was in office, for a lot of reasons. Some reasons that were totally legitimate. The invasion of Iraq turned out to be a huge mistake, and some that I think were just sort of partisan. And some that probably got to a deep misunderstanding of who he was. So it's that third part where you and I may appear to sound like apologists, but let me tell you why I'm saying that. I've had the real pleasure of having very quiet one-on-one conversations with him that I won't reveal what we discussed. And what I found was, I'm talking, you know, one-on-one conversations where I found a man, to my great surprise, of great humility, great wisdom, he and I had discussions about exactly what you're talking about, Tom. And then you and I and he had a broader conversation, 15 people, about what you and I are talking about. And then you and I and he and 500 people had a similar conversation at TMP. In my personal conversations with him about the idea, I can tell you, I think without violating the confidence of our conversations, that conversations he and I had when Trump was the nominee and then was elected and then after, he has profound feelings about the way this man, who he is at his character, who he is as a candidate, who he was as a candidate, who he is as a president. And he did not share them. And I won't say more than that, but I think you can infer what those were. And so this letter, the point you and I are both making is for him to come out. Just be very clear. He said to you and me, "It is not my job. Presidents should not come out and criticize current presidents."
That it's right? bad that for the country.
Say again?
That it's bad for the country for him to do
bad
that.
Bad for the country. But we were in a room where we had a bunch of people saying to him, "Why don't you?" Basically, there was people, it wasn't you and I, but people in the room were saying to him at this lunch we had, "You know, you've got to come out and say things." And this was 2 years ago. And he's like, "No way, not what the president needs to do." He wrote this letter June 2nd. And that's a huge deal. So I guess what we're trying to reveal is we know that for him writing the letter wasn't just like, "Oh yeah, you know, click the box. Every president's writing a letter." This was a big deal for him. The fact he's writing, it's a big deal. The words then become a very big deal as well. And again, if you look at the words, they're very measured. Also worth noting, it was from him and Laura. It wasn't just from him.
Yeah.
And, his words were still quite measured, and he doesn't really, as far as I'm looking at it quickly, I don't think he actually takes very direct aim at the president. He talks about the long-term challenges we have about bigotry and exploitation, strains in our character, etc.
So yeah, let me quote a little bit of it. He outlined some heroes, the heroes of America, from Frederick Douglass to Harriet Tubman to Abraham Lincoln to Martin Luther King Jr. are heroes of unity. They're heroes of unity. Okay. This part to me. He's calling for unity at a time where the leader is not. Now, and he starts...
What he's saying by omission, what he's implying is very clear.
Yes. So he starts there, and then at the bottom of the page, he says, "This will require a consistent..." And again, I think it's important. Let's like listen to the words. He's saying we've got to be consistent, so we can't let day five change the path. "Courageous," which is that thing of like, okay, I might feel a little fear in some of my conversations, but I got to be courageous. And then creative, which is we got to do something new. We can't just read from the playbook. We've got to come up with something that's good. So I like this part, and obviously it makes sense why it's selfish in a way. "We serve our neighbors best when we try to understand their experience. We love our neighbors as ourselves when we treat them as equals in both protection and compassion. There is a better way, the way of empathy and shared commitment and bold action and peace rooted in justice. I am confident that together, Americans will choose the better way." Now, again, you can read that as platitude. I read it as he means this in a literal sense, that to love your neighbor you know, again, it starts with that corny word, it's love, but then that, that action that it then requires, there's so much that can be born out of that. I want to read one more part. Sorry, how do I get to page? Oh, there it is, page two. Many doubt the justice of our country, and with good reason. Black people see the repeated violation of their rights without an urgent and adequate response from American institutions. We know that lasting justice will only come by peaceful means. He does say looting is not liberation and destruction is not progress, but we also know that lasting peace in our communities requires truly equal justice. The rule of law, and this is to me like the center of our community, the rule of law ultimately depends on the fairness and legitimacy of the legal system, which I would argue gets closer to what Neil was talking about when he talked about justness. Anyway, I don't know if you want to read any other highlights, but I just thought it was great.
Which is very quickly in this letter, right? So again, I think it's worth noting, he's showing, based on the personal conversations he and I have had and the conversations you and I have had with him, Tom, he's showing extraordinary restraint in what he's saying here. And that's part of his character and how he believes the presidency and past presidents are supposed to behave. If you read, I guess it's called Between the Lines, right? He calls for a courageous leader who shows empathy, and he talks about a better way. So those three points are pretty clearly not what's in the office right now, right? This is a president who's marked by a lack of empathy. Who's clearly not being courageous, and better way means something new and different. And I can almost guarantee you, in fact, well, I can't 100%. When he gets in the ballot box, I know he's going to vote for.
Yeah.
It's not going to be the guy who's in the office right now. And that's a fascinating question about where the Republican Party is right now. The party that I grew up in and that I was a member of for a very long time. And then you get to the Mattis letter. Do you want to do that?
Yeah. Let me read one more line. Cause I read it in reverse. I'm such an idiot. One more. This tragedy, in a long series of similar tragedies, raises a long overdue question. How do we end systemic racism in our society? He's a conservative. He said systemic racism, he believes it exists, and he asks how we end it. The only way to see ourselves in a true light is to listen to the voices of so many who are hurting and grieving. Okay, this is one I think is in the category of he's lashing a little bit. Those who set out to silence those voices do not understand them, do not understand the meaning of America, do not understand the meaning of America or how it becomes a better place. Amen to that.
So let's talk. I would imagine I've talked to a bunch of people in the White House and in former White Houses and, you know, government folks, and the phones are ringing off the hook. People from the Department of Justice and people from the legislature, people from the White House, etc. And I think the moment that really has driven most, sort of say us, people who understand how government should or shouldn't work from the inside, crazy, was this photo op that he forced in Lafayette Square across from the White House.
Yeah.
And so a lot of what the media is focusing on right now is the use of basically waving posse comitatus. And there's a name for that called the Insurrection Act. So a lot of people are very upset about the president saying we should take the federal military force and deploy them in cities and states to stop riots. And people are getting upset about that. I will tell you, I'm not upset about that. We've used the Insurrection Act before. We've deployed the U.S. military before to quell riots. We did it in 31 years ago in L.A. And that doesn't scare me. In fact, I'd rather have the military doing some of the hotter aspects of civil control than some police departments. There's so many caveats when I just said, but anyway, what bothers me is the president and the attorney general deciding that he wants, and I don't care that it's the photo op, whatever. Look, presidencies are photo ops. You know, there's so much media involved with this, but I care that a group of protesters who had permit for peaceful protest protected under the First Amendment across from the White House were dispersed with what appears to be tear gas and violence from a church step, which makes it even more poignant. There are nurses, and I think there were doctors and there were clergymen on that church step caring for people who were dispersed violently against the First Amendment. And then, yes, it was to further this really stupid ham-headed photo op, but, you know, let's not blame them for that. It was the violation of the First Amendment by the president with a uniformed member of the U.S. military walking across Pennsylvania Avenue to do it. Like, I am pretty sure that a lot of folks who understand that was appalling to me. And I bet that was appalling to Bush and Clinton and Obama and Carter. It would have been to Nixon. It would have been to, you know, any president we've ever had, I would imagine. So I think that's a lot of what we've seen. And I think that also kind of gets to Mattis, if you want to go to the Mattis letter.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And can I set him up just a little bit? So,
please.
A few years ago, both of my brother and father are Marines. Okay. And I've known about them. You know, if my father wrote me a letter today, he writes me letters a lot. It's going to end with Semper Fi, Dad. Like, that's who he is. And my brother's very similar. So I've known of Jim Mattis for a long time. And I spoke to Jim Mattis, I don't know how many, three, four, whatever years ago it was, about coming to the Nantucket Project. And at the time, my brother in particular, but my father as well, and others, talked to me about how revered this guy was, or is, but at the time was. He was, at the time, a retired general, and he was at Stanford. And so we spoke on the phone a few times, but then he was called away. He became the Secretary of Defense. Now, one thing the hierarchy of the Marine Corps is really intense. Like, it's, you know, this is like going up the ladder and becoming a general within the Marine Corps and with any of the branches, but I do have a particular reverence for the Marine Corps. Comes with a lot, man. There's a lot that goes along with this. And among them is an incredible adherence to protocol and processes, like intensely. Like, you are honored for your practice of procedure, and, you know, consider what rank means.
It's of the armed services, and they all would agree, it's the most Spartan and disciplined and strident service. And it's also the one that is most willing to take battlefield casualties, which is an unusual thing. So that's when I think of the Marines, I think of leaders who are, while heartbroken to do so, more willing to put their Marines into life-threatening situations, right? They want to be the pointy end of the spear. They know they will die at a higher rate to do so, and statistically they do. It's a different service than the others in that instance.
That's right. So this man becomes the Secretary of Defense. And you know, throughout that, and there are others, but there's speculation, we don't need to spend a lot of time on this, that some of these people who are in this, you know, in Trump's cabinet and government do it with, you know, a little bit holding their nose, those are my term, but they're doing it because they think it's a patriotic thing to do, and perhaps they can bring a certain level of something, let's call it goodness, to a challenged, some may say, administration. And that was the word on Mattis. That was the word on the street. I don't know that he ever said that specifically. I'm sort of, that there is a degree of speculation in that. And there came a time where he felt it was time to go, and we don't need to spend a lot of time on that either, but he went. And I want to add one other piece, which is that these guys have massive respect for the Constitution, and they know that they die or are willing to die for the right of others to protest. They celebrate that. They don't resent that. They celebrate that. This is who they are. This is, you know, this is what how they spent their lives. And, you know, my brother went to OCS however many years ago, and all the people who get in are these ridiculous physical specimens, and 50% of them don't even make it through the OCS, which is Officer Candidate School. And then after that, man, it's a intense process. Well, this guy becomes the senior guy in that. And so he has a very, there are other generals, he's not the only general, but he had a very specific reputation as a man of honor and a man of intellect, both of those things. Like, that's who this guy was. And so now he's out of his office, and now he's doing something that under normal circumstances would break a kind of protocol. So we said it about Bush. You can say the same about Obama, by the way. I think there's something here that's even more special that he wrote this letter. And because he's not a politician. He didn't sign up to be a politician. He signed up to be a soldier and somebody who practices a kind of discipline as a way of life on a regular basis. So he, I'll read part and then I'm going to turn it over to you. He wrote this: Donald Trump is the first president, and it's, again, this is what he wrote about our president in this letter. Donald Trump is the first president in my lifetime who does not try to unite the American people, does not even pretend to try. Instead, he tries to divide us. We are witnessing the consequences of 3 years, he's not saying this week, 3 years of this deliberate effort. We are witnessing the consequences of 3 years without mature leadership. There's that word mature. We can unite without him, drawing on the strengths of our inherent, drawing on the strengths inherent in our civil society. This will not be easy, as the past few days have shown, but we owe it to ourselves, to our fellow citizens, to past generations that bled to defend our promise, and to our children. That's pretty badass.
It's I mean, okay, so that letter written by any general would be a big deal. Any Marine's a big deal. Any former Secretary of Defense is a big deal. That's a big newsworthy letter. This is a guy who was appointed to and worked with this president for years, right? So, you know, he knows what he speaks, and we should take it, you know, very, very seriously. And he hits on a number of points. So, yeah, I mean, what more can you say, right? There's a couple things that are, there's two aspects of what's happening right now. Let's call it like the last 3 months that are new to me, right? Two things that are totally new for my experience, similar to what a lot of us are saying, is first time in my life, having paid a lot of attention to government since I was 20, 21, that I believe that there are key aspects of my government that are much less competent than they ought to be. And this is, I'm not referring to the president right now. I'm talking about the CDC, an organization I revered since 1995, like revered. Every time I could work with the CDC, and I got to do it a lot, and then I was a WHO official for a while, like I love the CDC. And I've just been so disappointed by how they've shown up in this crisis. This was their moment to be competent and lead internationally, and they haven't even led effectively nationally, domestically. And so that's a big piece of news for me. Like, wow, one of the organizations I would have picked as one of the top five parts of the U.S. government did a poor job here. So that's really newsworthy for me. I think that gets to this dynamic of you get what you pay for. We've been underfunding certain aspects of the government since the Republican Revolution, you know, since the 80s. And that's where we are. So that's one big thing that's been relevant to me. We haven't talked a lot about that, but I just want to make sure I mention that. The second thing is what we're talking about right now. This is the first time in my life when I feel like the Oval Office and parts of the legislature do not have the best interests of the government or the Constitution in mind. I've never felt that way before. No matter who's been president, no matter what party they were, no matter, even if it was some of the decisions I thought were absolutely horrendous, I believed that they were done with the best, at the person making a decision, the president or those key legislative leaders, I really thought was doing it with the best interests of the Constitution, the country in mind, even if I totally disagree with the decision. And it's the first time in my life when I've felt differently about that. And it's an amazing feeling. And it allows me to see through a lens very darkly and very obscurely and through lots of reflections, perhaps how a lot of other people in this country have been viewing their government for generations. I've never felt that way before. And then you have this litany of people whose opinions I respect dramatically, saying, feeling the same thing deeper, more intelligently, with more experience than mine. And then you get to, what have you and I been talking about since our first conversation, since Corona broke out, right? Which is, we have to be the leaders now. And this has been a moment when, in national crisis, we always expect the White House will lead. That's what the Oval Office is for. If anything else, is a moment of national crisis, and a moment of international crisis, all eyes turn to the White House. We said this in chapter 11 of our book from 2017. In a pandemic, all eyes will be in the Oval Office, and it's time for them to lead. And we've seen just a vacuum. We've seen worse than a vacuum, right? And so Mattis concludes with, "We can unite without him." Holy shit. Former Secretary of Defense, this guy. "We can unite without him."
You know, let me add just a thought onto that, which is, so, you know, it's been a while, but I used to go down to Quantico. My father took me to Quantico a couple of years ago, but I used to go down and visit my brother down there in different places. That's the Marine Corps base. And when you're there, you get a sense of who Marines are. And, you know, it's okay if people are against the civil, you know, the draft. Okay. But one of the bummers of the draft is that the demographics of the Marine Corps and the services generally are not widespread, right? So, you know, the members of the House and the Congress, I'm sorry, the Senate and the House, they don't have that many family members serving in the military, and therefore when they make decisions of war, they're able to do it without the emotions of their own children being in these situations. There's a whole other variety of things it does, but what I'm trying to say is they don't come from everywhere per se. They tend to come from a variety of places. However, pointedly, they are in heavily, as a percentage, right wing. There also are a fair number of African Americans in the services, and having to do with, you know, it's a good job. It's a way to get a career. Here's the point I'm making. These guys know what a General Mattis is. They're not like, oh, because Trump, you know, wrote some tweet like, "General Mattis is an idiot." They all know, these millions of men and women, that that's not true. They know that. You know, if it were a civilian leader who was always a civilian, well, they might not know that, but they know who this guy is. And that will have an impact. And I mean both things. One, what Mattis said, and two, how Trump reacted to him. I think Trump is doing certain things lately that will diminish, I hope, I'm being very political right now, but diminish some of what has supported him up to now. So I just wanted to make that
last, put more words on that last thought for me.
I believe, see, it's what I said in the beginning. I think there's so much going on right now that it's hard to know what's going on right now. And then the smoke's going to clear a little bit. And when the smoke clears, people are going to ask themselves where they are. And I think that when people see, because you know that church with the Bible moment, that ain't going away. When they start looting, we start shooting, that ain't going away. And then
yeah, we'll see. So many of these things go away. The guy's got,
but I just,
the guy just pummels us with.
I know, but I think Biden's going to make these things surface in a really powerful way. And I wonder what's the next step. With a Mattis, what's the next step? And I don't think they'll forget. I don't think a lot of these military guys will see this situation and their soul is just going to let it go. Like, it's just another moment. Maybe I'm too hopeful.
So you're saying that Krulak is so respected as a, not Krulak, Krulak is a former other commandant in the Marine Corps.
Yeah, he's
another great man. Mattis. You're saying Mattis is so respected by the Marines and others that this will have a real impact on a group that wouldn't otherwise be more Republican.
No. Who are young men and women who will go back to Montgomery, Alabama, and they will go back to Dubuque, Iowa, and they will carry some of that with them.
I hope you are right. I would look at the example of the Never Trumpers in the beginning of Trump's campaign, which consisted of an extraordinarily talented group of people who had no impact on where the Republican Party went in support of Trump. So I hope so. And that's all this, that's, you know, we're getting super partisan today, but, you know, I would like to say, someone made a comment on one of our talks and they said, my brother would look at your conversations and say they're left wing, but I don't think so. I hope people can look at our conversations and see them not as partisan. I don't care what party wins. I just care about certain principles largely enshrined in our Constitution being protected and enunciated and built. I don't care who does it.
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting, a lot of this stuff, because I totally agree with that, but the other part of it is some of this stuff isn't written down. Like, to be a unifier,
a lot of it is precedent and behaviors. That's right. A lot of it's not written down. you know, I'll mention his name because I haven't given him full credit for it, but one of my colleagues, a guy named Mike Hoppmeyer, who I think is one of the great creative minds, said right when Trump was elected, he said, you know, do you understand how much of the way the executive branch works and the military works that's based on precedent, not law?
Yeah.
And he enunciated a number of them, and it's extraordinary. I'll give you one. I'll give you really perhaps the most powerful and divisive of all of them that I can think of. The number of Supreme Court justices is not established in law. And so thereby the president and legislator would have the capacity to expand the number of people in the Supreme Court. So imagine what you can do with that. And I don't want to, you know, that's not really on topic today, but that's a precedent. That's not a law. It's not in the Constitution. There's so many other things like that. And if you don't have an understanding of why these precedents exist, if you don't have an understanding of the history of our country and the history of shared sacrifice or of sacrifice, then you don't understand why those precedents matter and why you should follow them. And this is a guy who clearly doesn't believe in those things. And that gets to example for my comment before on Pax Americana, right? You know, I talk about how three presidents in a row have weakened Pax Americana. I think Bush hurt it very badly. Bush 43 hurt Pax Americana, which is, you know, the 60 years of American leadership that mattered, 60 years of American leadership that made the world a much better place, I think, by every measure. I think Bush hurt that by invading Iraq. I think Obama hurt that by the comment about the red lines in the Middle East. And I think Trump hurt that by not even knowing what it is, not even caring about the concept at all. So, you know, and I make that last comment so you can see that I am an equal opportunity hater. I'll criticize all presidents. Right?
Well, so let me just take a step back and sort of catch up to what you just said. And that is that, you know, we started something that was a COVID thing. Today, we're talking about three leaders speaking out. We're talking about statues coming down. We're talking about Steve King. We're talking about it because of George Floyd. Like, that's why we're talking about it. We're talking about George, because of George Floyd, and we're talking about it maybe as significantly or more by the reaction to that. And that's what all these things are. That's what holds all these things together. That's why these things are happening. And so if I were going to observe it, like, wow, in my lifetime, and Obama said it, Mattis said it. Mattis said he's never seen a president like this. Now, he's not saying that, oh, I have a general comment. He's saying, at this moment in this time, I'm going to say this thing. And where does this go? I don't know the answer, but I'm a little bit hopeful.
Well, I mean, there's obvious steps. There are more people who could join Mattis, some of whom are dear friends of mine. There's the effective, like, what are we aiming for? And, like, let's just, I'll tell you, I'm aiming for Donald Trump to not be president. Like, I think that's a really important first step. But that's, even that, like, okay, fine. That's, you know, we'll have another president. We've had, what, 26 presidents or something since Gettysburg? I can't do the math, you know? Like, a lot of presidents. And we've had, how many presidents? We had 45 since the founding, and we still haven't solved the racial problem in this country. Far from it. So electing a president's a thing. You know, we had an African-American president for 8 years, and we didn't solve it. So having Biden as president is not going to be the solution, but it's a step.
Yeah, and I guess, go ahead. Well, I was going to say that I think what you're saying is right. I would also just add that might it be the case that that happens because we believe in this other thing more, and this is the thing. This other thing being a kind of justice and commitment and service, right? And that's why. So George Floyd, I'm overstating this to a certain extent, but George Floyd is why Donald Trump is no longer the president of the United States.
It'd be interesting to see. Like, you know, you can actually get really super concrete and you can look at voting blocks and wonder if these protest movement will hurt Trump or not. And there, I can make an argument that it hurts him and that it helps him. My gut is that it hurts him because it'll mobilize more voters. And the thing that's kind of ironic amidst all this, you know, millions and millions of people in the streets, it's unbelievable the mass of humanity that have come out in these protests. And you can look at What am I trying to say? So there's a massive number of people that are coming out, and you could say that that's clearly a mobilizing influence. But the irony of this whole thing is less than 50% of Americans vote in presidential elections, right? So here we are. We're at each other's throats. We have been when Corona came out. Why are you wearing a mask? Why aren't you wearing a mask? You know, we are literally at each other's throats when it comes to being George Floyd, right? We are at each other's throats. Yet only half of us are going to vote. If like 5% more people vote, which is a huge percent, 10% more people total, Biden wins. But more critically, the democracy is strengthened because more people are voting. If 5% more people voted and Trump won, I would actually see that as a positive outcome. Like more people voting is a very positive thing. Again, the irony is amidst this, we're at people's throats, we're screaming and yelling. Our country is, you know, the state of our union is not strong right now. Yet, if history is any proof, only half of us are going to show up and vote.
Well, let me.
If that changes, then the election changes dramatically.
Let me end on an observation and a hope. First is the observation, which is, and by the way, I want to just make sure people understood your point. If RP has a wish, it's that Donald Trump goes. His comment about the 5% more is more of a secondary hope, but I just want to, which by the way is fine. Actually, I think it's great. I want to observe the kneel down, not Neil Phillips. Because every time I see it, you know what I mean, right? The knee, take a knee kind of thing, right? I love it. I love it so much. I think it's an act of humility. It's an act of togetherness. It's a peaceful act. It's such a non-masculine act. You know, it's a surrender act. It's such a great symbol. I like it so much. Is it a Colin Kaepernick thing? It might be. And if it is, and it's being broadly embraced, to what extent I can't comment. I don't know. I like it when I see it. There's something about it that I really like. And it's, you know, could that symbol be something that we carry forward for some time? I don't know if you have a thought on that.
I think we certainly are going to see a whole lot more of that. And the just this amazing juxtaposition of obviously the knee on George Floyd murdering him and Kaepernick taking the knee is extraordinary juxtaposition. Couldn't have been better scripted. It's a horrible, nothing good about it. You know what I mean? But like the juxtaposition is amazing. But you know what's interesting about the knee? To me, one comment that we talked about in the Marshall Scholes manifesto, a little trouble getting that out, is that we think we're in a fight we actually aren't in. We think we're in a fight we actually aren't in. There's got to be a better way of phrasing that, but you know what I mean. And we have a whole show where we kind of talked about that. That's how I felt about the knee. And if you read Colin Kaepernick's op-ed, and it was actually written by him and one of his colleagues from the 49ers, maybe the colleague wrote it, but it's about what did we think we were doing when we took a knee. So on one hand, you have them taking a knee, thinking sort of what you just said, Tom. They didn't have a very defined point of view of it, but it had nothing to do with disrespecting the flag when they did it. In their mind, when they took a knee, they were saying what you just said. And I their words will be better than my bad memory of what they were trying to say. But they were saying, this is about justice. This has nothing to do with the flag. This is not criticizing the flag. It's just us reflecting on the need for more justice for African Americans, right? So that was their point of view. So let's say if they put a message out in the world, that's what they thought it would be. What was heard by many, many people, including this guy, including me, was disrespect for the flag. So at first, I saw that as a disrespectful act against the flag. And remember, it's during the Pledge of Allegiance, it's during the National Anthem, right? It's not just taking a knee at any other moment. I saw it initially as disrespectful to the national anthem and the flag, and thereby disrespectful to the men and women who have died in service of this country across all services. So the message they sent out was nowhere near the message I received. Message sent, not message received. And that became a huge issue, right? We think we're in a fight we actually aren't in. I think we now see getting down on the knee as a very different thing than a lot of us saw initially. And a lot of people, I think, are quite reasonable felt that way, the way I did about the knee initially too. I believe in their right to protest all day. I believe in their right. You know, if they had put a black glove up and done the sign of, I'm not that the sign is called, but the sign from the Olympics, Black Power, whatever it is. Yeah. If they had put the black glove up above their hand, I wouldn't have been concerned about that at all. But somehow I thought it was, I already described my point of view on that. So, but I think now we understand that it's going to be a hugely widely used symbol now. And hopefully it'll be understood now for the way it was intended, not the way I received and others received it for a while, which was as a kind of an anti-American, anti-veteran point of view, which was absolutely not intended to be. And so many things are like this. Why are you wearing a mask? What are you doing? Are you an East Coast elite that's criticizing me and you think that I'm a hillbilly and that I'm going to give you the disease? Like, what? No, God, not at all. You know, maybe I have a kid at home who has leukemia. I don't want to get sick and bring it back. But the inference, the ladders of inference that we run up are so extraordinary. We end up in battles that we think we're in battles we're not in.
Yeah, and that when I say let's not do what the internet says, that's what I mean. Don't just do what the internet says. Pause and look into it and try to understand it. Because, by the way, my reaction was fairly similar. I've always honored protest. I just think there's something very interesting and passionate and American about it. And I understand the tensions that people sometimes feel. But, man, you know, when you go to a football game now, like a kid's game, and someone gets hurt, they go right to the knee. We didn't do that when we were young. It's like a thing that people do a lot. It's also, again, I think that the notion that it is a sign of peace, it's a sign of surrender. There's something about that I just find so incredibly powerful. And so I hope it kind of lives on. And then just the last thing I want to say, and we should go, but I feel like we owe it to ourselves to ask ourselves, I'm going to make up a date between now and at a minimum the 4th of July. And I'm going to say beyond that, but just for now, ask ourselves to feel a certain lack of comfort and commitment to what this is. And what is this thing? It was a tragedy and really something that's maybe different than a tragedy. It's like an appalling act. And then a reaction that has had some appalling parts. And then a reaction that's had some really hopeful parts. And then the question is, if it's true that, like as Barack Obama asked us, as plenty of people have asked us, are we willing to innovate and be in uncomfortable situations? And I want to say that between now and the 4th of July, I want to check in with you on a regular basis and say, how's your uncomfort today? How's your innovation today? How's your courageousness in a conversation today? And just see what happens.
Hear, hear. And because she promises she watches all my videos, I'm going to plant a little trapdoor here. Yesterday was my mom's birthday. So we didn't get together yesterday. So happy birthday, Mom. If you see this, that means you do watch these episodes and you can let me know you saw that. You've been the best mother any boy could ever hope for. I love you. Thank you.
RP, thanks a lot as usual. And we'll see
Tom.
You soon.
Great to see you. Sorry to take that last part for a selfish act.
Not at all. Bye.